We woke late the next morning and partook of a plain breakfast. Then we cleaned up and put everything straight. A continual labour which was beginning to afford me a pretty clear insight into a question that had often posed me, namely, how a woman with the work of only one house on her hands manages to pass away her time. And at about 10, set out on what we determined should be a good day's journey. We agreed that we would pull this morning as a change from towing, and Harris thought the best arrangement would be that George and I should scull and he steer. Now, I did not chime in with this idea at all. I said I thought Harris would have been showing a more proper spirit if he'd suggested that he and George should work and let me rest a bit. It seemed to me that I was doing more than my fair share of the work on this trip, and I was beginning to feel strongly on the subject. It always does seem to me that I'm doing more work than I should do. It's not that I object to the work. Mind you, I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours. I love to keep it by me. The idea of getting rid of it nearly breaks my heart. You cannot give me too much work. To accumulate work has almost become a passion with me. My study is so full of it now that there's hardly an inch of room for any more. I shall have to throw out a wing soon. And I'm careful of my work, too. Why, some of the work that I have by me now has been in my possession for years and years. There isn't a finger mark on it. I take a great pride in my work. I take it down now and then and dust it. No man keeps his work in a better state of preservation than I do. But, though I crave for work, I still like to be fair. I do not ask for more than my proper share. But I get it without asking for it. At least so it appears to me. And this worries me. George says he does not think I need trouble myself on the subject. He thinks it is only my over-scrupulous nature that makes me fear I am having more than my due, and that, as a matter of fact, I don't have half as much as I ought. But I expect he only says this to comfort me. In a boat, I have always noticed that it is the fixed idea of each member of the crew that he is doing everything. Harris's notion was that it was he alone who'd been working, and that both George and I had been imposing upon him. George, on the other hand, ridiculed the idea of Harris's having done anything more than eat and sleep, and had a cast-iron opinion that it was he, George himself, who had done all the labour worth speaking of. He said he'd never been out with such a couple of lazy skulks as Harris and I. Huh, that amused Harris. "Fancy old George talking about work," he laughed. "Why, about half an hour of it would kill him. Have you ever seen George work?" he added, turning to me. I agreed with Harris that I never had, most certainly not since we started on this trip. "Well, I don't see how you could know much about it, one way or the other," George retorted to Harris, "for I'm blessed if you haven't been asleep half the time. Have you ever seen Harris fully awake, except at meal times?" asked George, addressing me. Truth compelled me to support George. Harris had been very little good in the boat, so far as helping was concerned, from the beginning. "Well, hang it all, I've done more than old Jay, anyhow," rejoined Harris. "Well, you couldn't very well have done less," added George. "I suppose Jay thinks he's the passenger," continued Harris. And that was their gratitude to me, for having brought them their wretched old boat all the way up from Kingston, and for having superintended and managed everything for them, and taken care of them, and slaved for them. It's the way of the world. We settled the present difficulty by arranging that Harris and George should scull up past Reading, and that I should tow the boat on from there. Pulling a heavy boat against a strong stream has few attractions for me now. There was a time, long ago, when I used to clamour for the hard work. Now I like to give the youngsters a chance. We came in sight of Reading about 11. The river is dirty and dismal here. One does not linger in the neighbourhood of Reading. The town itself is a famous old place, dating from the dim days of King Ethelred, when the Danes anchored their warships in the Kennet and started from Reading to ravage all the land of Wessex. And here Ethelred and his brother Alfred fought and defeated them, Ethelred doing the praying and Alfred the fighting. In later years, Reading seemed to have been regarded as a handy place to run down to, when matters were becoming unpleasant in London. Parliament generally rushed off to Reading whenever there was a plague on at Westminster, and in 1625 the law followed suit, and all the courts were held at Reading. It must have been worthwhile having a mere ordinary plague now and then in London to get rid of both the lawyers and the Parliament. At Reading Lock, we came up with a steam launch belonging to some friends of mine, and they towed us up to within about a mile of Streatley. It is very delightful being towed up by a launch. I prefer it myself to rowing. The run would have been more delightful still if it hadn't been for a lot of wretched small boats that were continually getting in the way of the launch, and to avoid running down which we had to be continually easing and stopping. It's really most annoying, the manner in which these rowing boats get in the way of one's launch up the river. Something ought to be done to stop it. And they're so confoundedly impertinent over it, too. You can whistle till you nearly bust your boiler before they'll trouble themselves to hurry. I would have one or two of them run down now and then if I had my way, just to teach them all a lesson. The river becomes very lovely from a little above Reading. The railway rather spoils it near Tilehurst, but from Maple Durham up to Streatley it is glorious. A little above Maple Durham Lock you pass Harrick House, where Charles I played bowls. The neighbourhood of Pangbourne, where the quaint little Swan Inn stands, must be as familiar to the habitué of the art exhibitions as it is to its own inhabitants. My friend's launch cast us loose just below the grotto, and then Harris wanted to make out that it was my turn to pull. This seemed to me most unreasonable. It had been arranged in the morning that I should bring the boat up to 3 miles above Reading. Well, here we were, 10 miles above Reading. Surely it was now their turn again. I couldn't get either George or Harris to see the matter in its proper light, however. So, to save argument, I took the sculls. Goring on the left bank and Streatley on the right are both, or either, charming places to stay at for a few days. The reaches down to Pangbourne woo one for a sunny sail or for a moonlight row, and the country round about is full of beauty. We'd intended to push on to Wallingford that day, but the sweet, smiling face of the river here lured us to linger for a while. And so we left our boat at the bridge and went up into Streatley and lunched at the Bull, much to Montmorency's satisfaction. They say that the hills on each side of the stream here once joined and formed a barrier across what is now the Thames, and that the river ended there above Goring in one vast lake. I'm not in a position either to contradict or affirm this statement. I simply offer it. It is an ancient place, Streatley, dating back, like most riverside towns and villages, to British and Saxon times. Goring is not nearly so pretty a little spot to stop at as Streatley, if you have your choice, but it's passing fair enough in its way, and is nearer the railway, in case you want to slip off without paying your hotel bill. We stayed 2 days at Streatley and got our clothes washed. We tried washing them ourselves in the river under George's superintendence, and it had been a failure. Indeed, it had been more than a failure, because we were worse off after we'd washed our clothes than we were before. Before we'd washed them, they had been very, very dirty, it's true, but they were just wearable. After we'd washed them, well, the river between Reading and Henley was much cleaner after we'd washed our clothes in it than it was before. All the dirt contained in the river between Reading and Henley we collected during that wash and worked it into our clothes. The washerwoman at Streatley said she felt she owed it to herself to charge us just 3 times the usual price for that wash. She said it had not been like washing, it had been more in the nature of excavating. We paid the bill without a murmur. The neighbourhood of Streatley and Goring is a great fishing centre. There's some excellent fishing to be had here. The river abounds in pike, roach, dace, gudgeon, and eels just here, and you can sit and fish for them all day. Some people do. They never catch them. I never knew anybody catch anything up the Thames, except minnows and dead cats. But that has nothing to do, of course, with fishing. The local fisherman's guide doesn't say a word about catching anything. All it says is the place is a good station for fishing. And from what I've seen of the district, I'm quite prepared to bear out this statement. There is no spot in the world where you can get more fishing or where you can fish for a longer period. Some fishermen come here and fish for a day, and others stop and fish for a month. You can hang on and fish for a year if you want to. It'll all be the same. The Angler's Guide to the Thames says that jack and perch are also to be had about here. But there, the Angler's Guide is wrong. Jack and perch may be about there. Indeed, I know for a fact that they are. You can see them there in shoals when you're out for a walk along the banks. They come and stand half out of the water with their mouths open for biscuits. And if you go for a bathe, they crowd round and get in your way and irritate you. But they're not to be had by a bit of worm on the end of a hook, nor anything like it. Not they. We left Streatley early the next morning and pulled up to Cullum and slept under the canvas in the backwater there. The river is not extraordinarily interesting between Streatley and Wallingford. From Cleve, you get a stretch of 6.5 miles without a lock. I believe this is the longest uninterrupted stretch anywhere above Teddington, and the Oxford Club make use of it for their trial eights. But however satisfactory this absence of locks may be to rowing men, it is to be regretted by the mere pleasure seeker. For myself, I'm fond of locks. They pleasantly break the monotony of the pull. I like sitting in the boat and slowly rising out of the cool depths up into new reaches and fresh views, or sinking down, as it were, out of the world and then waiting while the gloomy gates creak and the narrow strip of daylight between them widens till the fair, smiling river lies full before you, and you push your little boat out from its brief prison on to the welcoming waters once again. They are picturesque little spots, these locks. The stout old lock-keeper, or his cheerful-looking wife, or bright-eyed daughter, are pleasant folk to have a passing chat with. You meet other boats there, and river gossip is exchanged. The Thames would not be the fairyland it is without its flower-decked locks. Talking of locks reminds me of an accident George and I very nearly had one summer's morning at Hampton Court. It was a glorious day, and the lock was crowded, and, as is a common practice up the river, a speculative photographer was taking a picture of us all as we lay upon the rising waters. I did not catch what was going on at first, and was therefore extremely surprised at noticing George hurriedly smooth out his trousers, ruffle his hair, and stick his cap on in a rakish manner at the back of his head, and then, assuming an expression of mingled affability and sadness, sit down in a graceful attitude and try to hide his feet. My first idea was that he'd suddenly caught sight of some girl he knew, and I looked about to see who it was. Everybody in the lock seemed to have been suddenly struck wooden. They were all standing or sitting about in the most quaint and curious attitudes I've ever seen off a Japanese fan. All the girls were smiling. Oh, they did look so sweet. And all the fellows were frowning and looking stern and noble. And then, at last, the truth flashed across me, and I wondered if I should be in time. Ours was the first boat, and it would be unkind of me to spoil the man's picture, I thought. So I faced round quickly and took up a position in the prow, where I leant with careless grace upon the hitcher, in an attitude suggestive of agility and strength. I arranged my hair with a curl over my forehead, and threw an air of tender wistfulness into my expression, mingled with a touch of cynicism, which I'm told suits me. As we stood, waiting for the eventful moment, I heard someone behind call out,
"Hi, look at your nose!"
I couldn't turn round to see what was the matter, and whose nose it was that was to be looked at. I stole a sideways glance at George's nose. It was all right. At all events, there was nothing wrong with it that could be altered. I squinted down at my own, and that seemed all that could be expected also.
"Look at your nose, you stupid ass!"
came the same voice again, louder. And then another voice cried,
"Push your nose out, can't you? You two with a dog!"
Neither George nor I dared to turn round. The man's hand was on the cap, and the picture might be taken any moment. Was it us they were calling to? What was the matter with our noses? Why were they to be pushed out? But now the whole lock started yelling, and a stentorian voice from the back shouted,
"Look at your boat, sir! You in the red and black caps, it's your two corpses that'll get taken in that photo if you ain't quick!"
We looked, then, and saw that the nose of our boat had got fixed under the woodwork of the lock, while the incoming water was rising all around it and tilting it up. In another moment, we should be over. Quick as thought, we each seized an oar, and a vigorous blow against the side of the lock with the butt ends released the boat and sent us sprawling on our backs. We did not come out well in that photograph, George and I. Of course, as was to be expected, our luck ordained it that the man should set his wretched machine in motion at the precise moment that we were both lying on our backs with a wild expression of "Where am I and what is it?" on our faces, and our feet waving madly in the air. Our feet were undoubtedly the leading article in that photograph. Indeed, very little else was to be seen. They filled up the foreground entirely. Behind them you caught glimpses of other boats and bits of the surrounding scenery, but everything and everybody else in the lock looked so utterly insignificant and paltry compared with our feet that all the other people felt quite ashamed of themselves and refused to subscribe to the picture. The owner of the one steam launch, who had bespoke six copies, rescinded the order on seeing the negative. He said he would take them if anybody could show him his launch, but nobody could. It was somewhere behind George's right foot. There was a good deal of unpleasantness over the business. The photographer thought we ought to take a dozen copies each, seeing that the photo was about nine-tenths us, but we declined. We said we had no objection to being photoed full length, but we preferred being taken the right way up. From Wallingford up to Dorchester, the neighbourhood of the river grows more hilly, varied, and picturesque. Round Clifton Hampden, itself a wonderfully pretty village, old-fashioned, peaceful, and dainty with flowers, the river scenery is rich and beautiful. If you stay the night on land at Clifton, you cannot do better than put up at the Barley Mow. It is, without exception, I should say, the quaintest, most old-world inn up the river. It stands on the right of the bridge, quite away from the village. Its low-pitched gables and thatched roof and latticed windows give it quite a storybook appearance, while inside it is even still more once-upon-a-timeified. It would not be a good place for the heroine of a modern novel to stay at. The heroine of a modern novel is always divinely tall, and she is ever drawing herself up to her full height. At the Barley Mow, she would bump her head against the ceiling each time she did this. It would also be a bad house for a drunken man to put up at. There are too many surprises in the way of unexpected steps down into this room and up into that. And as for getting upstairs to his bedroom, or ever finding his bed when he got up, either operation would be an utter impossibility to him. We were up early the next morning, as we wanted to be in Oxford by the afternoon. It is surprising how early one can get up when camping out. One does not yearn for just another 5 minutes, nearly so much lying wrapped up in a rug on the boards of a boat with a Gladstone bag for a pillow, as one does in a feather bed. We had finished breakfast, and were through Clifton Lock by 8:30. From Clifton to Cullum, the river banks are flat, monotonous and uninteresting. But after you get through Cullum Lock, the coldest and deepest lock on the river, the landscape improves. At Abingdon, the river passes by the streets. Abingdon is a typical country town of the smaller order, quiet, eminently respectable, clean, and desperately dull. Iffley Lock and Mill, a mile before you reach Oxford, is a favourite subject with the river-loving brethren of the brush. The real article, however, is rather disappointing after the pictures. Few things, I've noticed, come quite up to the pictures of them in this world. We passed through Iffley Lock at about 12:30, and then, having tidied up the boat and made all ready for landing, we set to work on our last mile.